Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. To claim your 20% of Manscaped products, use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight we're kind of in the centre circle, but then we're out the centre circle and we're sort of in and around the midfield and we're dropping back and we're going forward and we're going to be a little bit all over the place. But that will become clear once I introduce tonight's special guest. But before I do that, I'd like to introduce my two wingmen for this edition. First of all, Mr. Paul McPallan. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Stu. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this evening's podcast. I've got a fabulous guest this evening, and I'm really looking forward to listening to their views.
I'm even more interested in the fact that we've got the blue half of Merseyside as a wingman this time, rather than the regular red half of Merseyside.
Yeah, well, you notice the difference in quality straight away, Stu.
Okay, brilliant. And obviously, as always, all the way from, sunny Spain, Gary?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Very sunny today. It's been a lovely day today. Yeah, I've had, over in Spain, I've had sort of the 4 days of purgatory and then the 2 days of delight about writing the book. So I've gone through the editing process and the 2 days of picking the cover. For my latest work, so I'm come out of that now. So good, happy, sunny day. Went out for a couple glasses of wine before dinner. Had a nice curry cooked by my wife, and I'm now settled and ready to talk about football with my friends and a fantastic subject and a fantastic book as well.
It absolutely is. Before we do that, obviously, how much about your book cover can you give away, or would you like to give away, or do you not want to give anything away?
I've been told I can't actually do anything until it's on the website, it's on Pitch's website, but it's orange is a big colour.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's a big clue.
The book's called, I mean, I spoke about the book a while ago, the book's called The Beautiful Bridesmaids Dressed in Orange. It's about the Dutch teams of 74, 78 before and afterwards. But I'll be putting a Twitter account up for the book soon and the publication dates, and the best thing about a book is better than writing is picking the cover. It's fun because you haven't got to do anything, you've just got to say move this thing, have this, can I have that picture, can I have that picture. So that's the best part of writing a book.
Well, I can't wait. So on to obviously this episode, like we say, sometimes you get a guest where I feel like you can pretty much ask them anything and they're going to know the answer. No pressure. But that's how I feel tonight. I feel like we've got someone who is going to be able to answer just about every question I've ever thought of, which is really exciting. Our guest this evening is Dr. Kevin Moore, who was the founding director of the National Football Museum. Even that should get people excited, which he led for over 20 years. Kevin worked in museums and as a lecturer in the University of Liverpool and Leicester before he led the creation of the National Football Museum in Preston in 2001, then went on to establish the new National Football Museum in Manchester in 2012. And obviously under his leadership, has attracted over 500,000 visitors a year. Also an internationally recognised researcher, lecturer and writer on football history. Kevin also advises football sports museums around the world and is currently working as a special advisor to the Chinese Football Museum. Then we've got where we go into the centre circle, his latest book, What You Think You Know About Football Is Wrong. Kevin's also published extensively academically, including the Routledge Handbook of Football Studies, which I actually do have to say I have a copy of, by the way, which I actually use at work. His passion is to bring football history to as wide an audience as possible. And like I said, people who are listening tonight, or sorry, to this episode, hopefully, are in for a real treat, as really all history teachers should be like Kevin. But also a member of the Super White Army at Prendon Park as a Tranmere Rovers season ticket holder. First supporting his hometown club, Nantwich Town, known as the Dabbers. And again, one of the questions, where's the origin of that name come from? I'm pretty sure he's going to be able to explain it to us. And like I say, it is just such a, I guess we're lucky really to have, like I say, somebody with such extensive knowledge of the beautiful game. And that's no disrespect to you and Paul, Gary as well. That's no disrespect to you two. But I've just got to say, I think this guy is going to be the man who just knows it all. So, Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, and what a build-up. I'm terrified now. I've got a terrible memory. But I know the trends in history. Don't ask me who won the cup final in which year. As I say, what was Wikipedia and the internet invented for? Look it up.
Okay, so to begin with then, Kevin, obviously the first sort of important thing is now, as luck would have it, I guess, I'm teaching on a football coaching degree, and I also teach a level 3 program as well. Both of those have sports history and culture modules in that I kind of asked to be put in because that's where my passion lies, in and around football. But it, from your opinion then, the history of football and its link to society, community and culture, why do you think it's so important?
Well, history, football's clearly a really important part of our history. It's part of our culture. So many of us are so passionate about it. And that goes back over 150 years now. So it means so much to people. And that needs to be recognised. It's not over here, separate from society. Your culture point's really important as well. Football is... it's not separate. It's not in a bubble. It's part of society. It reflects society. It's interrupted by world wars. It shapes things too. So, you know, you can't separate football from history, and we should explore football history as part of history in general.
It's a great answer. Like I said, I fully buy into what you're saying there. And Paul, I suppose in a way, football is so relatable, like Kevin said. You know, it's such a relatable topic. It's something that people have in common that actually it's a really good tool for education and educating people.
Oh, absolutely. I think even more so these days when people pre-COVID were so much more used to global travel, that these days with the expansion of the Premier League, you can talk to football about to practically anybody anywhere on the globe at the moment, wherever you go, which, you know, it's always a good icebreaker, isn't it? And I always have a little test if I ever meet someone on holiday. You know, my first question is always, do you like football? If the answer is no, I know we're going to struggle to get on together. If the answer is yes, then I think, right, we've got a bit of a basis here. And then my second question is always, which team do you support? And if it's their hometown team, then even better, I know we're going to hit it off straight away. So it's always, to me, an indicator of someone's background, how are you going to get on with them? How are you going to relate to each other? And, you know, as the song goes, if you know your history, it's enough to make your heart go, whoa, 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 I'll stop there. It's such a way of bringing people together. And on the case like, when England make progress in the World Cup, which is very rarely, but on the case that we do, it brings the countries together, and you can see the way everyone's buying into this dream. So it's such a powerful unifying force as well. And also, there's been many times in history when it's been the opposite. You know, you look at the Honduras-El Salvador conflict, you know, before the 70 World Cup, you can see that sometimes the passions can be inflamed a bit too much on the negative side. But yeah, undoubtedly, you know, football is history. It's something that binds people together, binds societies together, and gives them an identity. And I think when you see the newly formed nations like Croatia, the way they belt out their national anthems at a major competition, you can see how important history is to them, and the footballing part represents that.
Gary, this is, it's something we've sort of talked about on and off, you know, quite a while, and it's a subject that comes up quite regularly, and that's the sort of the importance, the responsibility of generations to keep the stories alive, to make sure they're told and then retold so they can be passed on and, you know, and not forgotten. I mean, you look, you know, you look at the, obviously the modern game, but if you, you know, if you look at, you know, from the birth of the Football League or the FA Cup or professionalism, you're looking sort of nearly, you know, nearly 150 years now. And, but it's so important that we keep the stories alive. We did one on black players. The other day we did a Centre Circle episode and looking at the first black footballers and, you know, and those stories from those early pioneers are so important. And, you know, and all of this is just so important, but it's also everybody's responsibility.
Yeah, it is. As Bob Cole and Kevin said there, you know, football is like a mirror to society. And, you know, just you and I have made a living out of talking about politics and football and society over the last few years, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 episodes of political football that we've done. But yeah, it is. And, you know, it's when I say it's a mirror, it holds a mirror to society, it definitely reflects the values, the ethics, the beliefs, often the bigotry of society that's prevalent at the time, and having a history of football is a massive element of having a history of society, and if we lose that, we lose such an important part of knowing. Because the old story is you don't know where you go unless you know where you've come from.
Yeah, very much so. And I suppose with that, you know, with sort of that in mind, you know, the creation of the National Football Museum, Kevin, you know, just a little bit about the genesis of that idea, a little bit about, you know, where it came from, you know, was it supported? Was it, you know, nationally, do we think it was needed? Was there opposition? You know, those sorts of things.
Well, it was started by Brian Gray, who was chairman of Preston North End at the time. He, from Backseas Company, they took on Preston North End as very much a community venture to revive the club as being... He was inspired by Prince Charles' business in the community. And so Backseas decided to take on Preston North End, which was really struggling, and completely reinvent it with a fabulous stadium that's been long complete, really to... Because football, your point, because Preston North End was so important to the people of Preston, it couldn't be left to languish how it was. So that was his vision. He wasn't trying to make money out of it, quite the opposite. And a great success and the great vision to put the National Football Museum as part of the redevelopment of the stadium. Now, there was opposition. It had been talked, of course, there has to be a National Football Museum. It's ridiculous that there wasn't one. I interviewed Sir Walter Winterbottom on another matter, and he went, oh, National Football Museum. Yes, Sir Stanley Rouse and I were going to do this in 1953 when they did the Football and the Fine Arts exhibition with the Arts Council. There was a football art exhibition, you may know, in 1953, very successful. Lowry won one of the prizes with going to the match. But he said, we tried to get the National Football Museum off the ground, but the time wasn't right. Good on you. Go for it. Preston's got a proud history, founder members, first double winners. But we did face some opposition. Some people said, football's not old enough. It's not been around long enough to have a museum, only 150 years. What would you put in it? A lot of negativity from the London media. Well, yes, fine, but it should be in London, of course. But we made it happen in Preston. We got the FIFA collection from FIFA. We got 9 million from the lottery and more besides. And, you know, there are some negatives to Preston as a location because it's only a city of 120,000 people, but there's 7 million people within an hour's drive. So, you know, And also, why not Preston, was our argument. I joined the project, believing in it, and we did make a success of it in Preston for a time.
Kevin, can I ask you a question there? I've been to both museums. I went to one in Preston as well. One of the things I loved about the Preston Museum was the fact when you went up the staircase, you could see Preston's grounds, and it just made it feel almost like a virtual football experience. And I thought... I think it's lost that, obviously, on the move to Manchester. But to me, that was one of the best parts of the visit to Preston, just standing on the staircase and seeing, I think it's a Bill Shankly you can see from where the staircase was in the far stand. So I really like the Preston Museum. I thought, for me, the location was ideal. And I agree with your point. Preston's not the most inaccessible place in the world, is it? You know, it's not that hard to get to.
Agreed. And that was really crucial to me because, A, all football fans want to see inside the inside the stadium. Of course they do. So that glass box, I fought for that because it was about to get cut on funding. We're running out of money to build a museum. I said, cut anything, but not the glass box inside the floodlight tower, because that's just amazing. And we did have a lot of visitors who'd never been to a football ground, so they wanted to see it. The only problem was we had to close the museum during the game, because otherwise people wanted to stand in the glass box. The museum was free and watch the football for nothing. We tried putting a barrier across, and in the end the club said, will you please close during the game? So we did. But it was brilliant and impressive because you could hear the fans on match day. You could feel in the Bill Shankly Cop, when the crowd in, you could feel that building move inside the museum. So, yeah, I mean, we were very proud of what we did in Preston, and it worked really well. But in the end, the football bodies didn't back it in Preston, and neither, unfortunately, did Preston City Council, Lancashire County Council. They didn't have enough money to back it, and so we got a fantastic offer to move to Manchester. It was finished in Preston. It was going to close. There just wasn't the money to support it, and that's how we ended up moving to Manchester. We couldn't convince the football bodies to back the National Football Museum.
Can I throw a Midlands card in here? The only place for a national stadium, the only place for the National Football Museum should be in the middle of the country, because that's easier then for everybody to get to. It should be in London. Why should it be in the northwest? Why should it be in the northeast? Why should it be in the southwest? It should be in the middle of the country. So for me, the National Stadium, the National Football Museum, should be in Birmingham. Logistically, it's easy access. It's massively easy access. Air, rail, road. I can't see an argument against it personally. You know, Manchester's, you know, it's not a million miles away from you know, I suppose Birmingham or one of the cities in the Midlands. But why is it not in the Midlands? That's the place where it should be. That's the place where the National Stadium should be, because it's national, so it should be access for everybody. And that's the place where the National Football National Football Museum should be, because it's national, and therefore it's easily accessible for everybody.
I can answer that.
Please do, Kevin.
First of all, to say I totally agree. I didn't want the new Wembley to be at Wembley. I wanted the new Wembley to be in Birmingham, as did most football fans. But we know why the FA chose to put it in Wembley.
Of course we do.
The corporate market.
Of course.
The fear of corporate boxes and all that corporate stuff.
Of course.
And that's why it's not a 100,000-seater as well. Yep. They were after that London corporate market, because they looked at it and they actually said to me, the City of London types and the business types won't come to Birmingham.
Yep.
And I said, well, that's ludicrous. They said, most fans wanted to be in Birmingham. And then the new National Football Museum possibly could have been in Birmingham. But then I have to throw this at Birmingham as well. If Birmingham had wanted the National Football Museum when it was struggling in Preston, Birmingham could have come up with an offer just like Manchester did.
Exactly, and so they should have
done. We were open to offers,
and so they should have. And given that, you know, the reason why there's a patently obvious reason why the National Stadium isn't in Birmingham, it's in London, is the FA headquarters. Where is that?
Exactly, always in London, and then actually inside Wembley. Yeah,
absolute nonsense. The costs of having a National Stadium in London are ridiculously more expensive than would be in Birmingham. The cost of hosting the FA headquarters in London are far more expensive. I mean, I'm not going to rant anymore. I mean, it's a case that doesn't. There's no argument against it other than, you know, a South East London bias, and, you know, and we all know where that works.
And it cost £758 million and nearly bankrupted the FA to build it.
Yeah. Sorry, Stu. Sorry, no, mate.
Because it's given me time to think of a question. So, I've listened to everything you've all said. Now, all things being equal, now don't worry about travel and accessibility for a second. So this kind of applies to all three of you. And I know there's probably no answer to this question. I need to make sure I phrase it correctly. But if you're, to me, the National Football Museum would look to be somewhere around the birthplace of the game, or somewhere that has strong links and association with the game, arguably from the early development of the game. That being the case, forget travel, forget geography, fellas, forget councils and money. Where would you, which area of the country do you think would have the strongest claim for the National Football Museum based on its identity with the game?
That's a really good, really good question.
Don't give me too much thinking time.
Right, I'll waffle a bit on this one. If you look at the history of the, I suppose if you decide to go for the professional game, and I know there's an argument to say, actually, no, you shouldn't go for the professional game. You maybe go back to the public schools where it was played at a very early stage in football's progress. To me, it has to be either the Northwest or the Midlands, because that's where the original Football League started. If you're using the Football League as the barometer of football history, and I think in England, there's a strong case for saying that. So I think the Northwest or the Midlands, I'd be equally happy with Birmingham. I think Birmingham's got lots of advantages. I'm also quite happy with it being in Manchester, because I think as Kevin's alluded to there, I know you said not to mention this, Stu, but the museum has to be financially viable. It cannot be a loss maker. You can't have a situation where a National Football Museum closes down because it's not financially viable. That would just have such a negative impact on the legacy of football in this country. So if you put me on the... But one thing I'm quite clear about is it shouldn't be in London. Absolutely no reason whatsoever why it should be in London. But to me, the Northwest or the Midlands are those two places. And I actually quite support the idea of it being in Preston originally, because I thought Preston, to me, they were the first team to win the double. They got such a rich heritage and history. You could argue it was where the professional game first established its roots. And you know, when you watch things like that documentary was on Netflix a while ago, was it the People's Game? When it took off the development of football in the mill towns. I mean, Preston was one of the original mill towns as well. So, I mean, to me, Preston was great as a location. I can understand why if it's not making money, it had to be moved. I fully support the reasons for that.
Yeah, I get it. And like I say, you're right. And that's why I wanted to take the caveat of money and geography out of it. I want, like I say, purely on a football heritage, football association, as in association with the game, not the FA. I was just interested in where you would put it. Gary, where would you have it?
I have to say, I'm going to adopt a sort of a politician's approach here and not accept the premise of the question. I'm not sure why it should be based in particular area, just because there's a certain claim to be one of the prime founders of the game, because you can probably find 17,000 of them across the country.
Oh yeah.
And there's probably 28,000 claims. 17,000 probably valid. There's probably 28,000 claims. So I'm not sure that has much sort of importance. And I think Paul makes a good point about the financial viability, because you could say it should be in, forgive me, I'm trying to think of some sort of, Hull has a decline, don't they? And certainly Sheffield. Lots of places around the country could have big claims. I'm not sure it's that important that they've got a big claim. They should have a claim. But, I think, as I say, earlier, to make it work, I'm trying to sort of tread carefully between the principle and the positive. There's an argument that say, okay, you should go to the birthplace of the game and make it there, but you don't go to the birthplace of natural history for natural history museum. You don't go to the birthplace of the aircraft industry for aircraft museum. You'd be Kitty Hawk or I don't know, wherever in America. So I just think that I don't think it's that important. So neatly sidestepping the question there.
I am going to throw the question to Kevin as well. It's purely because when we're listening to Kevin, football is such a tribalistic sport, and with fans with almost tribal tendencies and very possessive tendencies towards their club. And I found it quite staggering that clubs, that FAs didn't actually want responsibility for it or to take ownership. I struggled with that, which is why I then decided that I would take that responsibility away from them.
I just think it's because there's probably not, you see, and tribalistic is right. And if you're saying, where should the Manchester United Museum be? No one's going to say it should be in Scunthorpe. If you're going to say, where should the Newcastle United Museum be? No one's going to say it should be in Basingstoke. But with football, isn't that easy to pin down to a location. I think that argument is a bit sort of difficult to substantiate. So, you know, if I put that to one side, I'll go back to the logistics. I'll go back to the equity, shall I say, of it being in the Midlands. And, you know, I just think I can't see a case against it personally. And I'm not done in the Midlands anymore. I live in Spain, so I'm a million miles away anyway. But I just think logically, I can't see an argument against it.
For you, Kevin, where ideally, or you know, who, you know, which club, which area do you think could quite feasibly stake a claim for? Yes, we think it would be good, or it would be healthy for the game. It would be healthy for the association, the game, to have it here.
Right. Not in the Freemasons Tavern in London, A, because it's been demolished, and though the FA held its 150th anniversary dinner that I was invited to on the very back table, but let's not moan about that. I did get a chance to meet Prince William and invite him to the National Football Museum, so that was a plus. Not there, because the point is made, the game only becomes significant when it takes off in the Midlands and the mill towns of the north. It's professional football that makes football. It's the football league that makes football. The FA in 1871 had a meeting to wind itself up because it had set a set of rules. So it only set itself up to set rules. It had set laws, rather. So it thought about abolishing itself. So it wasn't actually very significant. Preston had a good case, but any of the founder members did. We always supported every club museum. I think every club should have a museum. The smaller clubs were tremendously helpful because they knew they weren't going to support a museum, but they helped the National Football Museum and stuff, and even with money. It was almost like the smaller the club, the more helpful they were. In terms of where it should be, we wanted more than one site. We didn't think it should just be in Preston. We should have a site in the Midlands. We should have one in London. We should have one in the Northeast. At least the hotbeds of football. Why not? We've got such collections. The Imperial War Museum has several sites. Football is important across the country. Why should you have to come all the way to Manchester from somewhere like London, for example, or from Newcastle? Why not have a branch there? And we did make those offers. The first thing we decided when I came to Preston was that was going to be home base. We'd get 100,000 visitors a year there, but we started, and that opened in 2001. But in 1998, we started talking to Wembley about a branch of the National Football Museum as well in Wembley. When I left the National Football Museum in 2017, we were still talking to Wembley about a museum in Wembley. We had some discussions, and I'm not going to say too much, with Birmingham and with other cities, but unfortunately, none of these additional sites came off.
That's a real shame.
Yeah, it's. I mean, like I say, this is just one of a myriad of topics. There is a question I'm going to ask all of you as well before we move on to the next bit. But in terms of how you choose items, Kevin, what goes on display, what doesn't, the rotation, how do you decide what is exhibited in the museum?
Great question. This is actually a one-hour lecture I give, but don't worry, I'm not going to do that now. I'm going to answer it in 1 minute, so I'll give you the super fast answer. Important stories, important objects, people's stories, ordinary people's stories in the game, as well as the greats, stories linked to objects, but also where you can contextualize an object with film and audio and bring it alive. Like Maradona's shirt from the Hand of God game. Don't just show the shirt, put it in its context, obviously. Same with the 1966 ball. Don't just have the ball there. Explain the significance of the ball, why it's made, why it's orange, who made it, what it's the story of the ball then, and what happened it after Helmut Hallett took it off the pitch, and then it eventually ended up in the National Football Museum 40 years later. This is all part of it. Three key factors, though. Make sure we cover the game at all levels and in terms of equality, diversity and inclusion. Try to cover at least all the professional clubs. And we did get tested, but we'd usually pass the test that we had something on display of Gillingham, for example, particularly when the chief executive of the Arts Council was a Gillingham fan, so, you know, and one of the main funders of the museum. You always look it up, and if needs be, you get something out. And they had won the beat Man City in that final, and we had the trophy. So that worked. And above all, choose objects that people want to see, because the displays are not for the curators, they're not for me as the director, CEO, they're for the public. So what do people want to see is crucial, because the museum has tens of thousands of objects. So what you see is only a small fraction. And also then you have temporary exhibitions and you can rotate. But this is why I really wanted there to be a museum, a National Folk Museum in Birmingham, Newcastle, London as well.
The fact
Liverpool. Sorry, and Liverpool. And we did talk to Liverpool for a time.
The fact of how much of a museum's actual, not stock, it's not a shop, but content is actually not on display always staggers me at what's still to be seen, what's to be viewed. But Paul, coming to you, the museums are great, aren't they? Because they literally bring history to life. It's right there. It's almost tangible. Obviously, you know, the stuff, the exhibits can't be touched, but it makes history real. So instead of it just being on the pages of a book, it actually becomes this three-dimensional, there it is, object that people have maybe read about or watched on screen in two dimensions. All of a sudden, that third dimension actually generates even more interest.
Oh yeah, I mean, from my visits to both of the museums, it was almost like going back in time, almost reliving certain experiences from my childhood, evoking certain memories about football, the game I grew up loving. I love in Manchester, you got programs from games from years ago. You got the old football cards collections, the cigarette card collections, things like that. I love the background and the detail to the events as well. I mean, Kevin mentioned there about the 66 World Cup. I love it in that exhibition that in the background, there's the headlines from the French newspaper calling the 66 World Cup a swizz and a setup, and England should never have won it. So it wasn't particularly jingoistic at all. I thought that was a really good bit of attention to detail that. And even all the stuff, I loved all the George Best photographs, because when I was a kid growing up, George Best was the one you wanted to be, the car, the glamour, the dolly birds, it was a life you could only dream of. So I think it got the balance right between, because I suppose from Kevin's point of view is you've got to appeal to the football anorak, but you've also got to appeal to the guys, not the football anorak. And you're always going to get the no-wall there. Are you wrong there, mate? You know, 1932, Gillingham, when the third division is off with it. I was, my granddad was at that game and that didn't happen. You're always going to be conscious of that. But on the other hand, you've got to attract a younger audience. And I think what Manchester done really well compared to Preston is they've definitely targeted, particularly Kevin just on the themes that they have. The themes are very topical. So, but no, when it's a European Championship, it's based on that. That they have themes on shirts, they have themes on competitions. And I think trying to appeal to all ages, to all groups, is a really, really difficult task. And it must be really hard to strike the balance right. And for someone like me, who is sadly a bit of a football anorak, I found there was plenty there to keep me engrossed. I mean, I love the fact you pay once and you can go back as many times as you wish to over the next 12 months. I could have spent 5-6 hours there and not even got past the first floor. So there's so much stuff there, and you can linger, spend as long as you like looking at things. And I thought the staff were very good as well, because sometimes you know, they came over, they asked you about things, and I think they judged on your responses how much they needed to intervene or not. And I think after speaking to me for 30 seconds, they just moved on elsewhere. But I mean, to me, that was just part of the experience. So, I just love the fact it brings memories back. And it invariably, even when it brings back the defeats for your own club, it's still, you recollect it in a more considered manner. It doesn't upset you anymore. So I found that. I mean, I was just in March, just before COVID kicked in, and I just loved the whole experience. And it also gave me a unique chance to touch a trophy I'll never see in my lifetime, the Premier League trophy.
Oh, me either. Gary, I always, when you're in education, and especially, if your passion is football or you happen to teach sport or whatever it is, and you can sort of see the benefits of it. But, things like the school curriculum, you can use, you know, like the Football Museum, you can use it for history, you can use it for geography, you can use it for politics. It's so multidimensional, and, you know, and it's a very much a social media driven age that we live in. It's very much a, you know, an age of touchscreen and instant access. But places like the National Football Museum, really, you know, visits should be on the school curriculum. They, you know, it can be used as a way to engage young people in stories that, yes, football is the backdrop of, but are actually stories, as Kevin said, you know, they are stories of our history, stories of our society, that, you know, schools and education also have an important part to play. You know, we looked at the FA, you know, you talked about the FAs and the clubs and stuff, but there's got to be support there from the Department of Education and those sorts of places as well.
Yeah. The problem is the governments tend not to be overly interested in football other than for PR reasons. And it's down to people like yourself, Stu, who are sort of pioneering football as a social history tool that, you know, is giving football a chance to breathe in social history terms. I've never been to the National Football Museum. I've sort of, you know, test that up now. One of the best football museums I went to was in Bilbao at Athletic Club, the San Mamés. The new stadium they built there. And that's probably and I've been on a few football stadiums when they do the tours and that sort of thing. And that's probably the best one I've ever been to, because it's not about the football club. It's about the city. It's about the people. It's about the relationship between the club and the people of the city. It's about how important the club is to the city. It's about how important the city is to the club. It's about how important the people are. And the relationship there, and as I say, it's a fantastic museum, and it should be. It's sort of almost emphasised that ideal that you've just mentioned, Stu, where you know, football is such a valuable tool for increasing an understanding about society at various times in the evolution of any country, but especially in the UK.
This is a topic that I could go on. Okay, I suppose, like Kevin said, you can have an hour just on how you decide what to exhibit. But bearing that in mind, I'm going to ask all three of you. Kevin, you'll know what's there, so your question is going to be slightly different. I'm going to ask you, Kevin, which is your favourite your favourite exhibit, your favourite piece in the museum. Gary and Paul, just to give you a bit of thinking time while Kevin's thinking of his, I'm going to ask you two, throughout the history of the game, if you could be tactile or would brought the opportunity to touch something from the history of the game, anything, it can be, don't worry about whether it exists or not in the museum, don't worry about that. Okay, this is again a fantasy question. What piece of football history would you like to have in your hands just once? So that's for you and Paul. Kevin, for you, you know, you're aware of what you've got, you're aware of what's at the museum. What's your sort of favourite piece that you sort of never get tired of looking at or sort of having as an exhibit?
Oh, easy. The 1966 World Cup final ball. You know, it's the greatest moment in English football history. It unites everyone because it's the England team. Took so long to get it into the museum. We got it in the end. And then it's one of the most popular items. But also, I have a kind of relationship with it because, for example, in the 2006 World Cup, it and I travelled to Germany, to the German Sports Museum, and we went on German Match of the Day together. They wanted the ball to go, and we went on Eurostar, and it had its own seat. It was more important than me. So I was with the ball at Eurostar, and they said, can you lie on the ground and hold the ball up on the O of Eurostar on the train? There are no pictures of me, only the ball. Put the ball in its seat on the train, no picture of me, picture of ball in seat. But then now I can say, because it's safe to say it now, usually you have to have two people with a valuable museum artifact. Two of us did travel, but we were in separate hotel rooms. So there was me and the ball overnight. You know, I've slept with the ball from the 1966 World Cup final. So it's almost like it's it's almost like I've anthropomorphized it. Do you know what I mean? It's not a bull. It's a friend. So I miss it. I must go to the. I know I sound completely crazy now, but it is a deep symbol, isn't it, of England's win. I've been close up to it. That's slightly bizarre, but the fact that, you know, there is no greater symbol of our greatest moment for the English team.
Brilliant. I can't believe it. Well, no, I can't believe it had its own seat, actually. I'm surprised it didn't have its own carriage. Paul, for you then, you know, the history of the game, any artifact that you can be given to hold, what would you pick?
Yeah, I've probably got a few possibilities here, Stuart. I mean, I've collected football programmes all my life, so one thing I'd love to have is the first ever football programme that was issued for a professional game. That would be my dream come true. I'd also love to have a copy of the first ever town that produced a football pink or a green one for after the match, so I had that report there in my hand. I think that would just be absolutely superb. In addition to that, I would love to have either the first photo shot of a football league game or the first bit of cinema reel of a football league game. And going to more modern times, more modern history, one thing I'd love to have in my possession is, I was privileged enough as a young kid to watch the 66 World Cup, I would love to have Pelé's number 10 shirt from the two games he played at Goodison in 1966.
Okay, great, great, great answers, great answers. Gary, you've now got the rest of all of football, all of time, from all of the world to pick from.
Right, okay. I mean, 66 is a classic, so, you know, I can't argue with Kevin's choice on that. Other than that, I'd love to have Cruyff's shirt from the 74 World Cup final. I'd like to go back to 1978 in the World Cup final against Argentina and just nudge that ball inside the post from Vincent Bridge. Hit the post in the last couple of seconds, and just look. Yeah, I mean, it was like the ball bounced like an off break. Just, you know, just look at it a little bit, cress it inside the post. Everybody be happy. Well, the Argentines wouldn't, but the rest of the world would have been. And you're talking about. I mean, what I'm talking about now is, and Paul mentioned a thing about sort of seeing things in three dimensions, and I think what museums also gives you a chance to do is to see things in four dimensions, so you can go back in time. Fourth dimension, and I guess other than that, I'd sort of like to, in the 19th of May, 2012, I'd like to be standing by Petr Cech when Drogba rolled the ball into the Union bag as Neuer dived the other way, and I'd like to just give that guy a big hug there, because that was probably my favourite football night in all time. So if I could have sort of in my hand, I'd be Drogba's hand on, just give him a high five.
I mean, I've got to ask you, because I want to move on to the book, Kevin, but I've got to ask, obviously, you mentioned Maradona's shirt from the quarterfinal against England. I've got to ask about the ball, because the ball is involved in two of the most iconic goals ever scored. And yes, the shirt is important. It's, you know, it's who wore it, and I get all of that. But the ball, you know, the ball that's handled in, the ball that is touched, I can't remember how many times I've written an article on it and counted it and everything, but the ball that is sort of is, you know, scores from, you know, for me, what's certainly the greatest individual goal ever scored. Do you know where the ball is, or, you know, what happened to it? Any part of it?
No, that's a very good question. I'm wondering where those shirts that these guys mentioned are already. Sometimes private collectors sometimes just disappeared, like the original Jules Rimet trophy. Was it stolen and melted down in Brazil? You know, there are all sorts of stories about these. You've got me intrigued. I'm going to look into that ball. So, absolutely. Probably in a private collection somewhere, but we may never know. And I agree, it's a great symbol of the game. But the Maradona shirt, interestingly, is always one of the most popular things in the museum. And I found that out because the cleaner said, this is the case we have to clean most. I said, what do you mean? She said, all the fingerprints. Seriously. So, and people get, it's double-edged for England fans. There is the hand of God, but everybody goes, but that was a brilliant goal. So it's the yin and yang of football, isn't it? The worst and the best. And by the way, first film footage of a football game. There is some training earlier, but it's 1896, Ewood Park, Blackburn Rovers against West Brom.
Oof. Oh, fabulous, Kevin. I would love to have a glimpse of that. Absolutely brilliant.
You may just find it on YouTube, but it's in the National Football Museum.
Excellent. I should look out for on my next visit there.
And if you find out who's got the ball, Kevin, obviously I can't afford it. That's not where I'm going with this. But if you do find out where it is, I would love to know. Like I say, for me, it's the ball that's been responsible for the... I know you're talking about the 1966 football, and I get all of that, but for me, that ball, those two goals, and the converseness of both goals, the villainy and the heroism for both goals. For me, it is the ultimate football. Anyway, well done, fellas. Great answer to that one. So the sort of the second half of the episode then, you know, Kevin, is the book that's come out. What You Think You Know About Football Is Wrong. And it's genius in terms of its simplicity. And that's not, you know, obviously that's not meant to be patronizing in any way, but usually the most simple ideas are the best ones. And this, by far, the minute you open it, the minute you read the first one, you're like, oh, okay, this is going to be great. It's such a simple idea, but yet it just hooks you in. And it's one of those books, and we talked about this the other day, and it was the Black Football Pioneers again. And some books just allow you to, I think it was Stephen who used the word, to ricochet from almost chapter to chapter, page to page. It's not a book that needs to be read in chronological order. It's a book that you can just pick up, have a flick through, read a couple, put it down, or you can go to the sort of the contents page, you know, and look down and go, oh, right, I want to read that one, and then I want to read that one. And that's how I like books to be for me. I like books that you can pick up, put down, come at from any angle and any order. But, you know, I know I've prattled on there a little bit, but a little bit about why that book, what, you know, what made you write that? Where did the idea come from?
Right, good question. If it had been left entirely to me, I'd have probably come up with a rather stodgy 300-page history of football with too many footnotes going, I can't quite say that as an academic. Oh, I'm going to have to put another clause in there. And I may still do that. Who knows? But actually, I met Matt Lowen, commissioning editor for Sport at Bloomsbury, and he said, why don't you write a football book all those years at the National Football Museum? It's just before I left, or as I was leaving. And I said, great. He said, give me some ideas. And I went, football, there's so many myths around football. And he went, bang, there you go. Write a book about football myths. And it was his idea to come up with 50. I actually came up with 63. And then, 50. Anyway, you don't need to know that. We ended up, I came up with the original list of 63. We kicked some out, we kicked some in. You know, there's a bit of a process here with the publisher. It's not just me writing it and sending it off. In the end, we were very happy. I wrote 52 and we put 50 in. And so it was his idea in large part, but I wrote it. So, and you know, that's in some ways how it should be. Because his view was, we want this to sell and we want it, which would be great, but it's not going to sell in huge numbers because it's not Gary Lineker's book of football myths. It'll sell nicely, but we want it to be readable. So short chapters. Was a key thing, written in an accessible style, just like it is in the museum. This is more for football fans because it's what you think you know about football is wrong. If you don't know anything about football, you don't know that you're wrong. So it is, of course, a book for football fans, but you don't have to be an obsessive to enjoy it.
Can I just, I'm going to come to the two guys in a second, but just a question I want to ask you. How difficult did you find it from writing an academic style, which is very much its own style, Harvard reference and everything that goes with it, to then writing a very digestible football book that would appeal to the masses?
Okay, I have two advantages over my academic colleagues, some of them. First of all, I have to write in a museum. And when you write museum text, and I would always edit it or even write some of it, you're writing for a reading age of 12. You know, and you've only got 150 words. Nobody's going to stand and read something for more than 150 words, and then captions, nice and short. So I'm used to writing succinctly, but well. And the second thing is, people say about my academic stuff, it's very readable, which is normally seen as an insult You know, well, it's not complicated enough. I can read your work. I've had this. Kevin, your work's very readable, therefore it can't be good. As though academics have to write badly. Less so in history, more with sociology. I can understand this. It can't be very good. So, yeah, historians tend to write better as well.
Oh, what a great answer. Paul, you know, one of the questions that you put together as part of the sort of the running order for this episode, and that's about football fans who almost cling on to myths. You know, it's myths that almost keep the game alive, isn't it? This isn't a bursting of the bubble. This isn't a, you know, sort of a slap around the face type book, but football fans do cling to myths and stories.
Yeah, I think it's part of, you know, it's kind of bred into you for being a football fan, you know, your particular team, your particular community. There are certain myths that, whether they end up being true or not, you just want to believe. I mean, if I just give one example, and I'm still not sure whether this is a myth or not, but I know Gary's written an article about this, which is why I'm bringing this up. But one of my friends has moved to Scotland, lives in a town called Aboyne, which is quite near Aberdeen. His work colleagues are massive Arbroath fans, and he says all they bang on about is that 36-0 win. Now, I know that Gary's written the story to say, actually, Dundee Heart might have actually won by more goals on that game. So whether that is actually truth or whether that is myth, you know, kind of the jury's still out on that one. But I think that gives you an idea of, even if it turns out not to be true, Arbroath fans are never going to believe the alternative version. They're always going to believe that they hold the record for the 36-0 win. So I think myth is something that binds people together, and it's part of the club's identity. And I think, you know, when we've been writing some of these special club edition magazines, you come across myths about the clubs you're writing with. And the judgment is, do you go with the myth because you know that's what the fans want to read, or do you shatter their illusions by saying, no, actually, that's not true? So I think the power of myths in football can never be underplayed. And, you know, one of the things that worries me in the future is whether social media will become such a dominating influence that myths that emerge on social media about football actually completely surpass the truth, and you're going to be fighting a losing battle to actually convince people, no, that is not true. This is the history. This is what actually happens.
It's funny. I was just about to ask Gary. It links great with my question for Gary. So bearing what Paul's just said there, Gary, what I was going to ask you is, social media, do you think it's sort of almost, as Paul said there, it almost embeds the myth? You know, it's so easy now to get myths embedded into the social conscience. Or do you think that social media almost, I don't mean it's sanitizing the myth, but it's taking away the mystery and the magic of the myth? Because myths are sort of word of mouth passed down. My granddad was at the game and this happened. But now social media is almost taking that away. So I'm quite interested, Gary, in your perception of where social media sits and this perpetuation of myths in the game.
This is a really complicated situation here. But okay, so here we go. I'm going to just sort of use a metaphor here. As is my want. And I think football fans on social media are a bit like the flightless birds of Madagascar. And Madagascar birds have lost the ability to fly because they've got no natural predators. So they've become flightless. And I think football fans on social media are very much like that, in as much as they tend not to look for, listen to, adhere to, take notice of opinions that don't match their own. So they never accept challenges to their established myths, beliefs, whatever you want to call it. For many years, I ran a business that employed lorry drivers, and I used to have this thing called lorry driver syndrome. And a lorry driver will sit in a cab on his own for 7-8 hours a day on his own with nobody to talk to. And he'd listen to the radio or whatever. He'd listen to the radio that he wants to listen to that reinforce his own beliefs. People read newspapers that reinforce their beliefs. They link with social media outlets that reinforce their own beliefs. So it becomes a self-perpetuating forecast, a self-perpetuating situation that you never get challenged, you never get questioned. So you don't question things. And if you don't question things, then you become
even more concretely believing in the myths around your club that you want to believe. Was that a little complicated?
No, I'm okay with that. Everyone's nodding. I think we're all accepting of that answer, Gary. Well done, as always. Excellently handled. Have a drink. Excellently handled. Kevin, obviously with the book, and we know with what the two guys, we know with what Paul and Gary have just been saying there, have you found whether fans are upset that the myth has almost been exposed, or do you find that football fans actually like the disproving of myths?
Ooh, good question. I haven't really had any abuse. I think what I have had is that, yeah, it's intriguing. And, you know, so people saying in some of the reviews, oh, it's really interesting. Oh, you set it up. Oh, I don't know if I agree with that. And, you know, your evidence seems pretty good, or I'm convinced. In others, they're going, well, it's a bit of subjective, that. So the one I think that has caused the most controversy, which slightly surprised me, because I think unless you take a moral position on it, so this is why I'm, let me just come out straight away. I made the argument that Premier League players are not overpaid. And I gave a case for that. It's part of capitalism. It's a professional game. And they go for that. And actually, compared to sports stars in North America, they're actually slightly underpaid. But I've had the negativity. They say I'm being subjective. Well, I thought I was being objective. And actually, they're being subjective, because if they say, yes, but they shouldn't earn that much, that's a different thing. And then why do we never say film actors earn too much, or bankers, or who hedge fund managers, or whoever they are, or pop stars? You know, why do we pick on footballers? So to me, that turned out to be the most interesting one. I knew it would be a bit controversial, because basically, somehow, the decision of society is that footballers are overpaid. Well, aren't all hugely paid people therefore overpaid? Why are you picking on football, was my point.
It's a great point, Kevin. I mean, you know, people say about, I was going to give another metaphor, is that, you know, house prices. So people say, oh, this house is worth X. It's not worth X. It's what somebody will pay for it. That's the definition of worth. Is what someone will pay for it. And if Harry Kane or Sadio Mane or Paul Pogba, someone's going to pay these guys £250,000 a week, that's what they're worth, because the definition of what something is worth is what something will pay for it. And everything else is just opinion, by definition. So you're absolutely right, Kevin.
Kevin, can I just ask you, in terms of footballing myths, you mentioned the pay footballers received. Did Johnny Haynes actually receive £100 a week, or was that purely a publicity call from Tommy Trindade, the chairman?
Ooh, good question. Maybe I'll have to look into that one, as if they ask me to do a second volume.
Thank you.
That's a perfect example, isn't it? How much is it PR stunt?
Because at the time in the 60s, when that story emerged, you know, maybe that started the criticism of footballers' wages, because at the time, £100 seemed such a fantastic amount to the generation who survived the Second World War, that someone's wages increased from sort of £14 maximum wage to £100 a week. And I've always wanted to know, did he actually get £100 a week, or was it purely a publicity stunt by Tommy Trindade? I still have no idea.
It's a great one. It's a great one, needs looking into. It's terrific.
Thank you.
I mean, obviously, you know, you said you'd written, I think, was it 63? You said, so you've already got a 13 head start on book two. Have you found that people have, well, I suppose like that, I suppose, you know, people have come to you with questions that makes you know, your mind constantly ticking over, Kevin, for where, you know, like you've just said there, it's a great one, it's one I want to look into. So since the book has come out, have people sort of almost come forward with more myths, you know, and see you as the myth buster, if you like, or whether or not it sort of fueled your, well, I suppose your an inquiring mind, if you like, to sort of prove or disprove the myth?
Yes, but only in forums like this, when you get chatting to people, and that's when they come out. I don't get it through social media or by email. So this has been the best, seriously. This is probably how to do a, you know, how to get a good list is from the fans themselves. You guys, the fans, know the myths. I mean, I got them from 20 years at the National Football Museum talking to people. That's how I got them. And from exploring the history, but mainly by talking to people.
I'm going to throw one in then. If that's how you like it, I'm going to, because I wasn't going to, but I say I heard a rumour. I didn't. I'm sure I read it somewhere that Brian Clough didn't pay £1 million for Trevor Francis because he thought it would be bad for his ego. So paid a penny short of £1 million. So he wasn't technically the first £1 million player.
That again strikes us. Possible PR stunt, possible paper talk, and you have to go back to the original sources. So this is the problem, you see. Once that's out there and somebody puts that in a book or it's on the internet, and it's out, isn't it? So unless somebody goes back to those original sources and the newspaper at the time and sees what Clough says and sees what was reported and looks at actually what was paid and what the deal was and in the archive, that's only how we can find out. And the problem with social media, as I already said, the internet is basically you can just cut and paste, can't you? So once something's been printed on one website, suddenly you cut and paste it and it's on hundreds. And it's the same list and it's the same myths. And it just gets regurgitated and regurgitated. But that's another really good one. Ideas here.
So I want to come to the first one because I'm guessing we'll all have an opinion on this. Now, obviously, we've all read the book. You know, we've all read your claim to sort of bust the myth. And, you know, number one is the ball did cross the line in 1966, in the 1966 World Cup final. Gary, did it?
You know, I mean, it's fascinating. When I sort of got the book, I mean, I was thinking, oh, God, yes, this is the ideal one. I mean, you won't know, Kevin, you won't know. A few years ago, I wrote a book about the history of England, the World Cup, and I was convinced the ball had crossed the line. And obviously, 1966 World Cup was a massive part of that book. And I probably spent, I don't know, I'm going back 3 years or so, or 4 years now. I must spend a week or so looking at various videos of the goal. And I couldn't find a single video, a single film, any single still image that would convince me that a ball across the line. And reading the book, I read about, you mentioned about the movie tone film. So obviously the first thing I did, jumped on the internet and typed in movie tone 1966 World Cup. And I'm not sure it's the same one, but I found one, a movie tone one, which has the angle of the goal, sort of almost, not quite in line, but almost in line with the post. And I'm still not convinced. It still doesn't look to me like across the line. And I've sort of, starting writing the book, I was convinced it was a goal, and I convinced myself it wasn't. And I'm hoping you can give me a link to a movie sounds good tone film that's going to convince me it did cross the line, because the one I found didn't convince me at all.
Paul, for you, did it cross the line?
Well, you know my views about the 66 World Cup, Stu. I think we had a whole podcast about that. I've remained to be convinced, but that's why I'm on the show this evening.
No pressure, Kevin.
So, Kevin, you know, like I say, it's your opening, and Gary's right. It is a brilliant, brilliant one to open with. So, right here, right now, you know, for you, did it cross the line?
Yes. And I've seen the footage, and I will now have to go and check the link and find it for you.
If you can email that link, Kevin, I'd be so grateful because I've been...
I will find it.
Bless your cotton socks, sir.
What it happened to me is...
Kevin, I would love to see that. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you.
It convinced me because it was found, but not by me, but a friend of mine is a professor at a university. He's written John Hewson has written a cultural history of the 1966 World Cup, and he found it. And he showed it to me, and I went, wow, it's over the line.
Does it show bouncing beyond the line, Kevin, or is it strikes the... Okay.
So I'm absolutely convinced, and I... crikey, I've kept the reference somewhere. I'll go and find it. You know what it's like on YouTube? Stuff gets taken down for copyright reasons. I will find it.
Bless you.
So I'm absolutely convinced. But you know all this, and then Sky did this analysis with computers, and Germans have done it.
Yeah, I've done all this, yeah.
You know all this. Yep. But when I took the 66 ball to Germany in 2006, they were asking all these questions, and the German media said to me, so was it a goal in 1966? And I said, yes. They said, why do you say that? I said, because the referee's decision is final. And they went, fair enough, yeah. Moving on. Yeah. It's as simple as that. It's a non-debate. The referee says it's a goal. It's a goal.
Absolutely right. I mean, I did an article with, on Hans Tilkowski, the German goalkeeper, and he quoted, I mean, okay, there's nobody nearer to the ball than he was at that time. And he, I mean, and you know, people might say, you know, the Christine Keel, the famous quote, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? You know, I'm not sure the exact line is, but something, I turned around, I looked behind me, and the ball was in front of the line, or something like that. But, you know, who knows? And I'd be delighted to look at that, because I want to be convinced that the ball crossed the line. So,
Were you not convinced by the three-hour analysis on Sky, where they did a computer-generated model and proved it beyond all possible doubt, apparently, on Monday Night Football, where they re-showed the final? Was that in 2016 on the 50th anniversary? Yeah.
Was I convinced by that? No, probably not. I think your smile probably sort of confirms that. I mean, you know, it's almost become a sort of a cause, a celebrity for English football fans, that it's an act of faith almost, that you have to believe it. You do not want to believe that. And as I say, before I wrote my book, I was absolutely convinced. I remember the game. I saw the game. I was not, 9.5 at the time. And I thought it was a goal at the time. And it's only when I sort of started studying it for the book that I began to question it. Because I won't say hundreds, but dozens, absolutely dozens of videos, and not a single, you know, as Paul said, I remain to be convinced, but, you know, convince me, I'd be delighted to be convinced, Kevin.
Well, I am convinced. And the other thing I say is, why do we keep punishing ourselves? We want 4-2.
I don't, and, you know, the World Cup, England won the World Cup, and I ain't arguing about, you know, and Argentina won the World Cup after Maradona punched one in the onion bag, you know, so, you know, you could say, well, that doesn't count either. So, I mean, you know, you know, we won the World Cup, and that's it. And, you know, her scored another goal as well. But, you know, it just for sort of academic purposes, shall we say, I'd be delighted just to see it. So, you know, if you find the link, Kevin, I'd be eternally grateful, mate. So.
I suppose, you know, I'd like to ask Kevin. Obviously, like I say, you know, we've read the book, and you've tantalisingly talked about 63. I'm not asking for the other 13, but I am interested. I'm interested in the process of why some were in, why some weren't in, but I'm more interested in ones that you thought or fought. I mean, obviously the first one is, you know, such an iconic moment, but were there any that you really fought hard for to be included in the book, and that you thought, you know, must go in there?
Yeah. Matt was fine about the rest, except when it seemed like the lawyers might get involved. So I'll talk about the two that got cut. So there's one about, you know, it was at the time when I was writing it, it's less so now, about football bad boys. You know, footballers these days, now we've got Marcus Rashford and many of them, and they've always, so many of them, done great work. You know, with a tiny minority of footballers that get drunk and misbehave, colour the view of all the rest now. And what I wanted to point out is this idea of the football bad boy. Oh, my God. Just go back in time. The football bad boy goes back at least 50 years or longer. And I wanted to include this chapter. The football bad boy behaviour is not new. And they said the lawyers don't like it. They're very cautious. And I went, it's all from published sources. You know, George Best doing this has been printed in a book by George Best. And they still wouldn't let me run it. In case. And the other one was Mussolini fixing the World Cup in Italy in 1934. And to me, it was absolutely cast iron. So much has been said about this. You know, it's just ludicrous how far he fixed it in so many ways. And seriously, the lawyers said, best not, just in case Mussolini's family sue us, or more pertinently, sue you, Kevin. So I went, okay. Well, I think this is crazy, but it depends what you mean by fix. Crikey, everything but everything, everything, layer upon layer to ensure that Italy won that. It was fixed.
Yeah, of course it was.
Just coming to you, Paul, there's a collection of 50, you know, we've talked about really just one or two at the moment. But in terms of favourites or one that maybe, again, you know, you can answer this however you want, whether it was one that you were disappointed that actually the myth was busted or you were happy because it actually proved a point that you thought all along. But what was one that that sort of particularly caught your attention in the book?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, there were so many in terms of myths, you know, and like everyone else here, you know, I like to think I've got quite a good knowledge of football, so you know, some of the myths didn't come as a massive surprise to me, but some did. I mean, two things really caught my attention. One was the chapter about the women's football not progressing in the 1920s. I hadn't realised a lot of the concerns was based on where the money raised for charity was going to, who was benefiting from the charity finances that were being paid at football games. I had no idea that was in the background. I found that fascinating, and can be indication that it wasn't actually the FA banning women's football. It was more concerned with the finances behind it and who was behind that. And the other thing, which I really enjoyed reading, was this eternal debate about who is the oldest football club, because the thing between Sheffield and Cambridge University I found absolutely fascinating. I didn't know about Cambridge University. I've got a little cards on the table here. And then it kind of linked into like this ongoing debate at the moment between who's the oldest football league club. Now Notts County are no longer in the league. Is it Stoke City or is it Crystal Palace? So these are these kind of myths about which team can actually claim to be the oldest and on what basis factually they can claim to be the oldest. I found absolutely fascinating.
I mean, I guess, you know, same for you, Gary, you know, in terms of sort of busting myths or breaking hearts or happy to prove a point, you know, where, and I suppose, to be fair, before you answer that, I guess that's part of what this book does as well. It's, you know, it's not just a myth-busting book as in, oh, I can't believe that's not true, but sometimes it's like, I knew I was right. It almost has that dual effect that it's, you know, that's what the book can do. I'd be looking through it and going, oh, I can't believe that's not true. And then you'd be like, oh, I knew that was right. And that's the joy of the book.
Yeah.
But for you, Gary, you know, like Paul, you know, one that particularly caught your attention or one that really surprised or intrigued you.
Well, you know, let's be honest, you know, this book's got, you know, so many myth busts in there that, you know, if you think you know about football, you don't. You need to learn about it because, you know, I looked at these things and I see a point there. And I think if you don't make that sort of acknowledgement, then you're a bit sort of insular. You're not prepared to have an open mind about things. So, you know, any football fan who thinks he knows a lot about football, read this book because you'll learn a lot. I certainly learned a lot. Not that I say I know a lot about football, but there's a few things there. I mean, Paul mentioned the women's football, and if you remember, Stu, a while ago, we had Lindsay Hooper on, talk to us about the Women's World Cup. And what she said is exactly what Kevin related in the book. And, you know, I was thinking, oh yeah, that's what Lindsay told us. And there's a lot of myths about women's football that, you know, are sort of lost in the commercialisation of it. But a couple of things. One of the probably one of my favourite ones was the penalty shootout. Is it best to go first? Is it best to go second? And the analysis that Kevin put in the book is brilliant, brilliant, and. I can only hope that Gareth Southgate has read that part of it. because, you know, we ain't got that great a record. I mean, we won one of the shootouts in Russia, but, you know, I just hope Gareth's read it, because that's it. I mean, and as Kevin said earlier, the chapters, they're not really long. They're nice and punchy, and they're right to the point, and they're very clear. And they explain situations without any sort of complicated format. But read it, Gareth. Read it, because it's important, mate. The other one I was going to mention is about supporting more than one club. And Paul mentioned earlier about important about sort of supporting your hometown club. And this has always been a thing with me. It's a massive thing. I mean, I come from the industrial West Midlands. I come from Warsaw. And I used to go to Warsaw with my dad since I was 5 till I was 25. I was going on my own. But I'm a Chelsea fan. And, you know, people say, oh, you should support your local team. No. You support who you don't well like. Don't tell me who to support. And I worked in Birmingham for a good many years and with a lot of Birmingham fans and Villa fans. I said, why do you support Chelsea? You support your local team. When you just want to analyse that, they don't support their local team because they're, you know, people live in Northfield in Birmingham or Great Bar in Birmingham, Sheldon, Agox Green, Selly Oak. There are 28 football clubs between their house and Villa Park or St Andrews. What they mean is they looked at the girl next door and didn't fancy her. So they went to the next housing estate and 3 miles down the road to find the girl they found a bit more attractive. Now, I don't mind who you support, but get off your high horse and stop telling me to support my local team. Support who you damn well like. So I really thought that was a great chapter.
Likewise, Kevin, I really identify with that chapter because I started reading and thinking, you know, no, this is rubbish. People don't support more than one team. I'm not having that. And then I kind of thought, well, hang on. I go and watch my local Long Lee team being on a regular basis. Whenever they're playing away sometimes, I go and watch Tranmere. A couple of times I go and watch Wigan Athletic. I've even watched Preston a few times. And suddenly I was thinking, actually, he's right. You know, I'm an Everton fan, but I've got a soft spot for lots of other teams. One of whom, when I was a teenager, was Chelsea. Chelsea were my second favourite team all the way through my teenage years, you know. And it's something that, you know, sometimes people are afraid to admit they've got an interest in another club. And, I fully understand what Gary's saying there, because although Gary supports Chelsea, I'm sure he's still got a soft spot for Walsall. You meant to go and see Walsall play at Everton with Bernie Wright playing on football for Walsall.
It's a classic example, one of those chapters, and there's so many of them in Kevin's book where you think, at the end, if you've got an open mind, you go, I got you, mate.
Look, guys, you know, we're well over the hour, and, you know, like I say, this could almost be a two-parter. But I think, and a question that I suppose I'm going to ask Kevin first, but I'm going to get your opinions on it as well, Gary and Paul as well, and obviously, like I say, it's something that I'm passionate about, and based on the entire conversation that we've had, what we started with regards to the museum, you know, where we've gone here with, you know, myth busting and the storytelling, but the facts that surround it and the social and cultural elements to these, you know, these tiny chapters. But, you know, sport or football on the national curriculum, you know, in schools, you know, do you think it has a place, Kevin?
Absolutely. Football, sport, key part of our culture, means so much to so many people, but such a key part of our way of life, our culture. So, of course it should. Can't believe it's not. It's part from that sense, though, that sport isn't culture. So you've got the Department for Culture, and they've changed the name, but I think it's still the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, you know. So sport isn't culture, and sport's not connected with the media, is it? No, but sport's not. Of course it's culture, and it's a really important part of the culture for so many people. So it's a whole way of life, isn't it? And therefore it needs to be studied. And what you said before, this is what we found in the learning programs at the National Football Museum. Kids are turned off by all sorts of subjects, do it through the lens of football, suddenly they're hooked. And then you can get through that to history, through that to racism, sexism, etc. Through that, football poet working with them, they're writing poems about football. 3 weeks later, they're writing poems about how they feel about life generally and their parents and everything in their life. You've used the power of football to engage and liberate people. So, you know, I could see a curriculum that just starts with football and sport as the unifying feature, and then we'll go and do chemistry and physics, but how do you bend the ball, and maths. Everything's in football, isn't it? The curriculum wouldn't be football, but start with football, business. There's no subject that isn't art. There is no subject where you couldn't start with football and then go to it. And are the kids going to be engaged with that rather than starting with, you know, whatever chemical formula?
Have you thought about being the education minister, Kevin?
I'm being the wrong compliment.
Really? Paul, for you, you know, listening to Kevin's sort of impassioned speech, which obviously just fills me with joy, but in terms of your opinion and, you know, and football and sport and its place in school, not just in the changing rooms and on the playing fields and in the sports hall, but also in the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, I would struggle to add to what Kevin so eloquently said there, because you know, that I 100% support every point he's made there. I mean, one of the things that surprised me from when I was involved in education is that sports and or football, when the government was pushing these cross-curricular themes across all areas of the curriculum, I was always amazed that the history of sport was never a cross-curricular theme, because as a way into children's minds, sport gives you an in that other subjects can't offer. I mean, Kevin alluded there too about learning chemical formulas and the barriers coming down straight away. Whereas I think sports and football is a way into the minds of young people. It's something they've grown up with. It's something they're surrounded by. It's something they're interested in. And if I just give a very, very poor example from back in my own school days, I remember as a 14-year-old, our English teacher could never get homework sent from those people. People weren't doing them. Nothing turned up on time. One week goes, I give up. Your homework this week is write about your last visit to a football match. The following Monday morning, everyone in the class handed the homework in. It wasn't all boys' school, but you could just see that that was the effect. It worked instantaneously. And you see the penny dropped there. You know, I could get more of a response here by concentrating a bit more on bringing kids' experiences into the classroom rather than imposing history onto the kids.
It's, yeah, and, you know, I'm sure there's, you know, loads of examples, but, I guess, Gary, you know, the two guys have, you know, spoken very eloquently and clear, but, you know, just your opinion on sort of, you know, football and, you know, like you say, we've done loads, 50, 60 sort of episodes of the Political Football Podcast, you know, and we say the same thing, you know, everyone's a school day, and, you know, and for an hour, we're both sat there learning about politics, we're learning about history, we're learning about geography, and it's all through the medium of football, but you learn so much alongside it, or we have anyway.
Yeah, you did right. And here I am, I mean, sort of on a podcast with, you know, a doctor, an academic, a retired teacher, and a university lecturer. And I'm sitting here, you know, as a, and I'm going to give my opinion as a non-academic. But, here we go. So, football moves people. People are interested in football. It opens doors. It's an access. Should football, to the history of football and sport, be a part of that? Yes, it should. Now, here's the sad part. Will it be? No. No, it won't. Because the powers that be, the powers that are, do not believe that. You know, I mean, all four of us think that's wrong, but I don't think they give a tuck because what we think. They don't value football. They don't see it as the key to open the door to further studies that we see it as. And so, will it be? No. Should it be? Yes. Sad, but true.
It's quite a morose way to... I do agree with you, Gary. I absolutely agree with you. It's quite a morose...
You're fighting a good fight, too. You're fighting a good fight, buddy. I mean, and more power to you, mate.
It's a morose way to finish, but to be fair, the group that I teach 16 to 18-year-olds at the moment, and we've actually put them into a... We have three groups of 16 to 18s at level three, and we've created a football group. All play football for a local under 18s team. Really good lads, not overly academically gifted, but bonded by football and their love of the game. And at the moment, in my module, we're looking at the early history of the game. And obviously, we've been Armistice Day. And, you know, we looked at the First World War, you know, and the first comment was, oh, they played, didn't they, on Christmas Day? And, you know, you go through that part first, but then what it does do is it allows you to put into context actually what happened in World War One, and they're there, and, you know, and today, you know, they couldn't believe what we're talking about—the Battle of the Somme, the way, you know, the direction the war went in, how much longer it lasted than they thought it would last, and all of a sudden, just, you know, although it sounds corny and idealistic, but the sort of the comment that football initiated gives you an in, like Kevin said, it gives you an in to then broaden their horizons, broaden their thinking on so many other subjects. And they are a group who are just bonded by the game, but you can get so much into them. Or we've got so much into them in the first 6 weeks, just purely through the game, that obviously at school they were just kind of resistant to because they didn't use the right channels to sort of engage them. But
you should never apologise for being idealistic, Stu. being idealistic is the only way you achieve ideals.
It's never been valued education, that, Gary.
Yeah. It's been brilliant. You know, Kevin, it's been every bit as wonderful as I thought it would. I'm only leaving you with one task, and that is to trace that World Cup quarterfinal football that Maradona punched into the goal. Once you've found that, I'm on it.
I'll
leave you alone.
I'm not heading off to Argentina during this COVID period to go.
That's okay.
Maradona, oh, he's still got the ball. Can I just come in and say one thing? I nearly went for the Christmas truce football games as a myth, because it's interesting. It was a myth and now it's not a myth, but it's still kind of a myth in a way, because it isn't what we thought happened, but games did happen. But there was a time where it was a myth, because we didn't have any direct evidence that it did take place. And of course we still don't have a photo, but we have enough information to show that games of some sort did actually take place. But it's really indicative of the myth making. Thankfully it's true, but there was a danger that all of this was actually a myth, because we wanted to believe it, didn't we? We wanted to believe it.
Can I ask, Kevin, did the Germans win on penalties?
Well, no. If there was one game where there's a score, an academic colleague looked into this, and actually the Germans did win 3-2, but it was against a Scottish regiment, so, you know. No offence to a Scots there. There were English involved in the game as well, but historians have really come to this recently. For a long time, it looked like the only proven game was a Scottish regiment against the Germans, not the English at all. So you've got to go back to the sources, the diaries, etc. And, you know, this is why history is important. Even if by doing that, you find out it wasn't quite like that.
It's, like I say, it's been a brilliant hour and 20, wherever we're at. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us and, well, just being able to answer every question, really.
Well, thank you. I've absolutely loved it. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm going to raid your back catalogue now, because it's great fun. I've enjoyed listening to you guys, and it's been like a great chat, you know, informal, relaxed, and tremendously informative. I've learned so much. So terrific fun to do. So thank you so much for having me on.
Trust me, anytime. And I mean, anytime. Paul, you know, again, you know, this was your find. This was your gem that you brought to us. Thank you very much for sort of, you know, coordinating this and bringing all this together.
Yeah, and thanks to you for hosting us, Stu. I mean, you know, there's no way I could even come close to hosting the podcast with your immaculate style and mellifluous tone. So, you know, it runs seamlessly as ever when you're in charge. But can I give a big thanks to Kevin? The book surpassed my expectations. I enjoyed every second of it. As you mentioned before, Stu and Gary, it's a book you can dip out of. And at the end, you put it down and think, yeah, that's right. Or, yes, I was right. And it provokes a reaction, which I thought was a real plus point of the book. And Kevin, I think from the base of the questions we've asked this evening and a few things you've raised yourself, surely there must be a volume to this, because I think the more you get into footballing myths, the more there are to explore. And the way you've just talked about that German football game there, I mean, that is always a book in itself, you know, the research behind it. But I think the style of this book is fabulous. So thank you so much for coming on the show this evening. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. And you know, really look forward to reading any more of your articles or any more books that you bring out in the future. And thanks for your input on the National Museum. That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
And Gary, like we say, I mean, this is why we do it, isn't it? To be fair, this is exactly why we do the podcast. It's a very selfish reason. I am aware that we are selfish people here, but this is exactly why we do it.
I mean, you know, if you can have more fun with your clothes on a Sunday, actually it's a Thursday today, isn't it? It's a Wednesday. With your clothes on a Wednesday evening, then I don't know what it is. But, you know, talking about football with your mates, and especially having somebody informative, but so easy to talk to as Kevin. And, you know, I'll just echo what Paul says. You know, if you're a football fan, read the book. It's a great book. And you'll say, oh yeah, I knew that, or wow, I didn't realise that, or is that true? It makes you think about things that you thought were true, which I suspect is probably the idea behind the book anyway. So, you know, all I can say is, Kev, if you write series two, come back again, mate, and have a chat.
All that's left for me to say, normally it's just thanks for listening, bye, but on this one, it's hopefully people have learned something. Hopefully we've sort of started an inquiring mind. You know, if we have young listeners who are listening to this and think, oh, actually, I might have a look at that, or I might have a little bit of read of that. Please go to the National Football Museum in Manchester. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. And Paul's right when he said you could spend 5 or 6 hours in there. No problem at all. And obviously the book, you know, What You Think You Know About Football Is Wrong. And, you know, I can only echo it, is one of those books where every single chapter you will have an opinion, and you can come at it from any angle you want. And I'm not saying you'll never be right or wrong, but there's no correct way to read this book. You just go with what you think and what you feel. And that's, to me, that's the best way to read a book. But now all that's left for me to say is thank you for listening. Please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.